Peter, this will be fun. Can I reenact something that happened just 7 days ago?
Oh, yes. That was just a week.
It's only about a week. Yeah. This will be a real theater of the mind, but okay. Here we go.
All right.
I was sitting outside in a socially distant writing session with my writing partner, friend of the show, Johnny G.D. Jackaloni.
Excellent.
When a bee, an adorable bee, flew by my face. And as I'm an adult, I calmly waved it away and went on with my writing. I didn't do that, Pete. I got that slightly wrong. No, what actually happened was I screamed, get out of here, fuck off, nature. And that was like my instinct was to scream, get out of here, F off nature, while like wild. And that was a bee, Pete. As you reminded us in just an episode or two ago, we live in a world of murder hornets and what were they, manslaughter worms?
They were hammerhead murder worms.
And yet I'm still treating bees like they're air sharks. Like it's very embarrassing to say the least. And so during our podcast of anxiety, sometimes we every now and again like to share something that might help mitigate our anxious or fearful feelings. So I looked up bees. Because I know bees are super important to our environment and vital and stuff like that, right?
Sure.
You want to see what I found, Pete?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Look at your screen, please. What's that, Pete? Pete!
What are they doing? Because what they're doing right now is something that I thought only humans did.
Certain species of bees take naps in flowers after they get all pollen drunk. This is true! In your state, a photographer in Portland took this picture. He said that one of them, they were staggering around like they were drunk, which they get when they after they pollinate. And one walked over, like staggered over from one flower and curled up next to this other one. And they just took a nap for like a couple hours. This is of two globe mallow bees covered in pollen, nestled together, having a little bumble snooze. And I just think that is so charming. Do you have any thoughts?
I don't know how to have thoughts about something as adorable as that. I just don't.
Right?
That is absolutely fantastic. I'm going to, if you have
a podcast, able to put it somewhere?
If you have a podcast app that will support it, look at it right now because I'll change the artwork on the show to this. Because it's that good. And we'll put a link in the show notes if you don't.
Fantastic.
That's
so anyways,
crazy.
My day started with F off nature, and it ended with bees taking naps and flowers. And I don't have anything else to say about that, Pete.
How do we do a show about poop after that?
Well, we're about to find out.
Cue the music.
And there's nobody out there like it like I am. There's nobody out there that can say my name.
Welcome to What's That Smell? A sometimes funny podcast about humans and their anxieties. I'm Tommy Metz III.
And I'm Pete Wright.
And every week, we each drag one of our deepest, darkest anxieties into the light to share it, learn about it,
and hopefully laugh about it with all of you.
Now is the time to reach out to us. Send us the story of your anxieties to somethingstinky@whatsthatsmell.net. Again, somethingstinky@whatsthatsmell.net. You can be as anonymous as you want, and we will talk about it. Pete, anything else to add?
Become a panic pal. Get a sticker. More later.
Wow. Okay, we'll talk about that later. But in the meantime, I'll go first. Way back in season two, in an episode titled The Case of Calamity U, you talked about your anxious feelings involving school. Do you remember that?
I've been thinking about it since.
Ever since? As you listen to that when you're trying to go to sleep?
Yeah, every night.
I remember telling you about the common anxiety dreams I still have to this day about searching for a class I can't find to take a test that I'm not ready for. Well, I don't know if you know this, but in these COVID-tastic days, I found myself with a little more free time on my hands than usual, so I re-entered the nightmare factory of academia voluntarily.
What? Why would you do that?
Because I want to get smarty.
How's it working so far?
It's been great. And I mean this.
That's
been
good.
Really great.
Oh, man, that was a hard left turn to sincerity.
Right. For the past 10 weeks, I've been taking a course from UCLA Extension called The Sociology of Mass Communication. And as my annoyed friends will attest to, I have found it fascinating, and I like to talk about it way too much. Spoiler alert, I'm going to be bringing up some of the anxious issues that the class has brought up in our mediated world later in the season. But not now. Because for now, I just want to focus on something I've been dealing with about the class itself versus what the class has been teaching me. You talked about school anxiousness in general, and I'd like to narrow the focus to something I'm dealing with right now, this week.
Great.
Excited.
Yeah, no, it's real talk.
Bees, Pete. No, we already did bees. This isn't about bees. Pete, how do you feel about writing papers? When was the last time you had to write an academic paper? Do you remember your feelings about it?
Yeah, I'm much more of a fiction guy. No sources. Sources trip me right up. If I have to tell
you, just want to free write it.
Yeah, I just want to lie. I'm okay at it. I got pretty good at it early in college, and then I switched over to journalism, and that, you know, you hone some skills. And so I think I'm okay at it now. I was terrible at it in high school. Terrible, terrible. But I'm pretty good at it, I think.
How did you get good at it? You said whole skills, just practice.
You just practice a lot. You just write a lot of short stories, news stories where you are, you're constantly checking sources and keeping a rigorous sort of bibliographic sort of history book of all the things that you study and learn. And
yeah.
And I think there are some habits that cross over there. And so by the end of college, by my sort of junior, senior year, I was pretty good at it. I didn't have Excellent. A whole lot of anxiety about that. But what you are asking me right now is, it puts me back to when I was 20 and I had that skill. And suddenly I'm feeling like I'm standing in a tank slowly filling with water from the toes up. I'm realizing I haven't done it in a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, well,
Let me give you my quick backstory. I was a humanities major with an emphasis in English, so my entire life was papers in college.
Yeah.
I don't remember them giving me a ton of stress because as an English major, that's just sort of the natural order things. But I have a paper for this extension course due in less than a week. It's actually due on Monday. And it is stressing me out. This will be the second paper that we've had to write for the course. And my approach avoidance behavior is through the roof. And I'm procrastinating getting started on it in a way that I haven't been doing for the course as a whole. I've been really attaboying and running at this course full speed. And I'm not sure why I'm so incredibly stressed out. I'm doing very well in the class. And I got 19 out of 20 points for my first paper. And I'm taking this class for my own edification. I'm not doing this to become doctor of sociology of something. That's not a thing.
Yeah.
I guess, well, no, you it is, absolutely really is can a be thing. A doctor of sociology.
But that's not shows what you're not in. A candidate for it yet, but okay.
I'm really struck out. Yeah. Oh, no. My thesis. My oral defense is this afternoon. Anyways, I'm taking it for my own. So all of that to be said, the risks could not be lower. And yet, I am really, really stressing out. Now, one of the big problems I'm having is the professor wants a bold thesis, and I don't have one yet. Or I'm afraid mine isn't bold enough.
No, you just write your thesis, and then you highlight it, and you hit Command-B. See what I did
That's
there?
Why I only got 19 out of 20 is because I italicized my thesis in the first paper. And she was like, nope. I double underlined it. So now that you know that I... Yes, because it feels like a muscle that I hadn't used.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of... And so... But the fact that I've already written it... I just don't know why this one is so hard.
I got it. I can at least talk to you about why it's giving me anxiety right now, and I can't stop twisting on my wobble board.
Okay, go ahead.
Because even though you've already written a paper... Because your enthusiasm and excitement when we've talked about your class before... Yeah. Over the last couple of weeks, has all been rooted in how enthusiastic you are about the material, about reading and ingesting and taking it all in. It's like so great to be exposed to all these wonderful things.
And it has been a significant amount of reading.
A significant amount of reading. But there's a lot of joy that comes from like learning and being exposed to these new ideas. Huge. It's great. And when you have to write a paper about it, you have to demonstrate that you have actually engaged in it, that your brain is capable of taking all this in and regurgitating these ideas in a way that other people can understand, other people who are professionals in the field. And I think more so than a test, which is just like, you know, writing facts, right? An academic paper like this is asking you to demonstrate integration, and that is terrifying, because what if you can't? What if you don't? What if you aren't? That paralyzes me as an adult. Like,
right.
when you already live with anxiety and you feel like the system that you have to trust is a system you can't trust yet, like, you don't do it enough to demonstrate that you have any capability at it. And I feel like that's terrifying. That would immediately kick off late onset propulsion. Like, I would do what you're doing, and I would wait until midnight the night before, and then I would start writing. Yeah. And then it's like a rocket ship.
Actually, that's what happened with my first paper. Is, again, I did well on it, and I liked the paper, but I did it all in one day,
yeah,
the day that it was due. And so I so ran out of gas that my conclusion, what we had to do is we had to compare in depth four different news sources on the same day at the same time and talk about, like, depth, coverage, variety, all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And the paper was about, I think, 13 pages long, maybe. And my conclusion was maybe half a paragraph. And it pretty much said, well, that's the news. Like, I ran out of gas so significantly.
The academic equivalent of jazz hands?
Totally. Yeah, I think my last paragraph said, look behind you. And then I was just like, and then I just ended the paper. But luckily, she overlooked the fact that the conclusion was terrible. No, what you're saying makes a ton of sense. And even while you're saying it, I came to a realization. I think I'm trying to accidentally tie everything together.
Yeah.
And it's a 10-week course with, we have read notebooks and notebooks and notebooks full of stuff. And so maybe I'm feeling like I'm taking the words bold thesis as a little bit too strong.
Yeah.
Actually, I looked up things to try to help myself about writing anxiety. Spoiler alert, there is a ton out there. So I am not alone. But the idea that I was afraid that my thesis isn't bold enough because I don't really have one, this connected to something I read in an article from the Writing Center from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They say writers can seek, quote, flow, which usually entails some sort of breakthrough followed by a beautifully coherent outpouring of knowledge. Flow is both a possibility. Most people experience it at some point in their writing lives, but it is largely a myth. Inevitably, if you write over a long period of time and for many different situations, you will encounter obstacles. That's very helpful for me to read because it reminded me I've been wrongly waiting for this earth-shattering revelation to pop into my brain, and I will rewrite sociology and everything to just flow out of me. And that puts a lot of pressure on myself for an unrealistic situation. That's usually just not how it works.
Truly. Writing, you know, I remember this experience in graduate school. Like, the whole issue of writing academic papers at a high level is it has to happen one sentence at a time. My experience is, if I find flow, I've also unearthed a lot of crap. Like, I write page after page very beautifully, quickly, and the result the next morning is, that's terrible. That's nonsense. Right.
Right.
It's writing is crafted, and it doesn't, like the writer once said, you know, true writing doesn't begin until editing. So sometimes you just have to vomit words on the paper.
Right.
And then start really shaping it. But I totally get that experience, because you want to create something that's going to wow the institution. Right.
Right.
You're sort of,
well, because you're on a pedestal. I admire the professor so much, and I've loved the class so much. It's like I want to really, I don't know, stand out. But what, I'm not a doctor.
And she's
a doctor. I'm not going to.
Let me ask you this. As that teacher-student relationship, like, you fall right back into that groove. I mean, what you're describing for me, it sounds a lot like you want to impress her, but you also want to demonstrate that she's done a hell of a job. Right.
Right. Yes.
You want to honor that relationship by doing the right stuff.
That's interesting. I never thought about that. But yeah. And she's so passionate about it. And I find that very intriguing and inspirational. And also, I really have done all the work. I've done all the reading, and I did all the recommended reading. So part of it is also wanting to tap dance for her, I think, and show how can I show that I read every single thing and thought about it critically.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure to put on myself.
It's a lot of pressure.
I am student 9. For her.
Yeah.
We are not going off onto the
well, you want to make sure that when you ask her out on a date at the end of class, she says yes, right? Isn't this end in a movie? Did I tell you the subject of my very first academic paper?
No.
I had this great idea. I was in the sixth grade. They wanted us to write our first, like, let's string a bunch of paragraphs together and come up with like an I think the target was like 8 or 10 pages, right? On a subject. Yeah. I thought, this is going to be great. It was exactly that relationship. I remember Mrs. Milligan. I remember the entire experience. She assigned this thing. And I came back where I wrote down my sort of thesis, the topic that I wanted to write on. And I handed it to her in class one day. And she turned it around. She looked at it. She read it. It was one word. It was space.
No. Oh.
And she turned around and said, a little broad.
Yeah.
And I had to go back home and workshop it with my dad. And we came up with, I think, a better yet still incredibly broad topic, which was the Apollo space program.
but still,
that has a focus. It's better. Yeah. It has a focus. And that is just it. Like the fact that you have read so much, you are developing one of the most important muscles, which is being able to stop reading. Right. At some point, you have to be able to filter. And that's really I applaud you because I think that's really incredibly difficult and terrifying.
I appreciate it. I'm thinking about I've written the conclusion, which is, do you like me? And then I'm going to have two boxes. It says yes, no. Hope she doesn't write maybe. Okay, so yes, so I've already identified that I have a bad habit of tackling large projects all at once, and that can lead to burnout.
Yeah.
And when I did some research on this, I did some more research, and I found it is extremely common. And health blog Go Ask Alice suggests writing a paper in several sittings. Of course.
Yeah.
That makes sense all in the world, and I'm going to be doing that. I already have plans for how to space it out. They they had a whole bunch of different things, but I had two more just in case anyone, if we have students that are listening to this, or if anyone has a big paper. These are two things that didn't really occur to me, and so I thought I'd share them if that's okay with you, Pete.
Sure.
One is actually one that you just said, that sometimes you have to vomit up words, your favorite word. Start writing even before you can envision your entire argument. Getting words down on paper may help you come up with the rest of your writing assignment. Try free writing or diagramming to inspire ideas. You already came up with that, and that's exactly true. I need to do it step by step. And most importantly, I need to start. And this another one is so obvious, but it has literally never occurred to me. And I wanted to see if this was just like, oh, of course. Compose different parts of your paper in order of ease. You're not required to write in sequential order as long as the final product is well organized.
Yep.
Some find it helpful to start with the sections that come naturally and move towards the more challenging parts. That has never occurred to me.
Really?
I've never written a different part of a paper and then gone. I've done that when revising, revising certain parts, but I've always written a paper start to finish. I kind of thought like that's how you have to do it.
Let me tell you, I think this is another one that I picked up in journalism school. So two tricks I want to give you. Number one is I would just say, even if you don't know what the easiest parts are versus the hardest parts, just start with the meat of your paper first and write your conclusion and introduction at the end, right? So you write the whole meat of the paper, write your conclusion, and then go back and write your introduction. I think it's incredibly challenging. Once you've done this, it's hard to imagine writing an introduction first because you don't know what the paper ends up being about. Until you've written it. Then you go back and write an introduction, and it's like, chef's kiss perfect, because you've already written the paper. You know what the hell you're introducing. So that's
interesting.
That's number one. And number two, if you have this opportunity, I don't know if Foster is available, but if you have the opportunity, and this is one of the hardest things that you can do in editing, once you write the meat of your paper, have somebody else read it aloud to you. Right?
read it aloud,
to you, because I promise you, your ears are far better editors than your eyes. And when you hear your words read back to you, just have a little notepad and piece of paper and take notes on things you want to edit. And don't ask this other reader to make any judgments at all, because what the hell do they know about sociology?
Just dictating.
Just
right.
Read it. Just read it. And occasionally you might have to say, hey, stop and read that back again. Make sure it flows well. Make sure there. I mean, you'll hear typos. You will hear typos that your eyes will not catch. I promise you. I promise you. It's an amazing, amazing thing, for particularly for academic writing. And I don't, I think it's, it's really good. Look at that. Right. You didn't even think that old Pete would have any insight into this stuff, did you? Old Pete. He just gets on his old horse and rides around a shack.
He can't get the horse out of the shack. It's been in there forever.
It's a shack horse.
Well, this has been very helpful, and I was expecting to be doing the teaching, but the teacher became the student. So thank you very much, Pete. And I think I have a bold thesis now. I think I've decided on one. It's going to just be a picture of bees taking a nap in a flower, and then the word discuss.
Weird. Nailed it in one. Construction of the Ore Pendente de Pisa, the Pisa Bell Tower, began 840 years ago. It's a freestanding bell tower of the Cathedral of Pisa, known not for its incredible design and cylindrical structure. No, this tower is known for its nearly 5-degree lean. That's right, the Leaning Tower of Pisa. It's like the Hunchback of Notre Dame saying, man, I'm a man. Do you hear me? I'm a man in here. We know you're a man, Quasimodo, but you just can't argue your most defining feature. It's written on the tin. The Leaning Tower of Pisa has survived 4 major earthquakes, and it still stands, consistently surprising civil engineers. Surface restoration has been ongoing, though, with 100-year stretches of no work at all. Engineer George Milanakis at the University of Bristol says it's actually the softness of the soil, the same soil that causes the tower to lean, that allows it to survive seismic event after seismic event. It reduces vibrations such that the tower doesn't shake during earthquakes. But the Pisa Bell Tower is the lucky one. Without foundational support, structures topple. Like the Leaning Tower of South Padre, a 31-story condominium that was imploded in 2009 because the reinforced core of the structure had sunk more than 14 inches in expansive soil and pulled itself apart. Or how about the Transcona Grain Elevator, a storage facility used by the Canadian Pacific Railway? Built in October 1913, the structure didn't last a single day before it started to collapse slowly into the ground, twisting itself over 27 degrees across its axis. Then there was the 13-storied building in Shanghai. The building completely collapsed, falling sideways rather than imploding. Investigators think the foundation failed when another project, an underground parking garage construction site, failed to take into consideration pressure differences and caused a section of the tower's flood wall to break apart. That's why you should consider becoming a What's That Smell Panic Pal, because buildings aren't the only things that require support. We're not running a single advertisement this season. Instead, we're asking you for a single contribution of $35 to support all of Season 5. That means you're helping us offset the costs of our production, podcast hosting, and time, and becoming an integral part of this show. Plus, members are notified of our recording sessions and can join us for a live stream each week to watch along, in addition to getting access to finished episodes in a custom podcast feed early. Thanks for your support and for helping us build a strong foundation this season.
And you get a sticker.
Tom.
Pete.
What do you have there lying on your desk? You have anything lying on your desk? Just pick up a thing. Yeah. Anything. Pick up a thing. Show me a thing.
Thermometer.
Thermometer. All right. This is great. This is great and appropriate of our human-centered season. So it's a thermometer. It's an electronic thermometer. You use it for checking your temperature. How long do you have it?
I do. If you remember from the COVID sessions, I got that first one from Amazon that spelled the word thermometer wrong. This next one I got probably about a month, 2 months ago,
okay,
a month or two.
2 months. So let me ask you, at what point does that object cross the line between being useful and becoming trash, a thing that you would consider getting rid of?
I guess if it didn't work. If okay. it ran out of batteries or stopped working, I guess.
Okay. All right. I had
Is that
this,
a good answer?
It's a fine answer. You're a fine human being. I had this dream the other night, and I'm going to tell you about it. I actually had the opportunity to join a psychotherapist who does dream work on another Ooh. Podcast and just pulled me apart. It was crazy. And so this is a dream that I had, and I used the same sort of exercise that I used with this dream therapist, and it's amazing to me kind of what just happened. So I want to tell you about the dream. Okay. My whole family, we were here in my home, and every time we would leave the home, we would clone ourselves. And so when we'd come back, there would be two of us.
Ooh.
Yeah. And this happened over time, and suddenly we realized that we each have to take the responsibility of disposing of our clones so that there's only one of us, because the house can't sustain that many people. And so we each had to kill our clones. And my son took his clones and pushed them off the roof of the house over and over and over, just walking like lemmings off a cliff. And my daughter was literally slashing her clones' throats, wrapping them up in old towels and duct tape. And the last thing I remember is her screaming, "I'm out of tape. I'm out of tape. I need duct tape." I don't remember how I was doing it. I don't remember how my wife was doing it. I just know that there were a lot of us around and the house was filling up and we had to kill our clones. Okay. So I was led through this dream exercise. I applied this dream exercise. And as I'm making notes, things started coming into focus. I'm walking around my house and there's two or more of everything. Cases of seltzer, laundry detergent, stacks of unsent graduation announcements sitting on the stairs, books. I actually have two copies of books on the bookshelf, like a bookstore would. Why do I have two copies of books? In this case, it's like, I don't know, I ended up buying two or three copies. They were autographed copies or something, but I haven't given them away yet, and they're just adding up. It's just more stuff in my house. Now, I look at your place on video. I've been to your apartment. It's pretty spiffy. Like you keep you keep kind of a Spartan place, and I know you only have eight books. I'm generally pretty good at keeping a sparse space. But it turns out there are a lot of people out there who are not, who can't let go. And what occurred to me is I imagine, just as I've seen the amount of stuff grow in my house, the stuff that I have trouble letting go of, that pandemic anxiety might be revealing some new behaviors in others that is also caused and causing anxiety. So today, Tom, I would like to talk to you about hoarding.
Hoarding has always... Hoarding has always continued. No, hoarding
has always
hoarding has always tickled me in an uncomfortable way.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say what I'm saying, but because I really don't have any hoarding tendencies, but something about it seems so insidious or so like, what's really going on there? I don't know. It's very interesting and something. It seems very scary to me.
Yeah. Yeah. But first of all, I think the same way it's easy to like watch a Buster Keaton movie and laugh when he steps on a rake, you know, like laughing at other people's pain. I think mass media culture has made kind of a cottage industry out of lampooning hoarders, right? Because visuals of hoarding are extraordinary. Have you ever watched any of like the reality shows around hoarding, Hoarders?
Hoarders, yes. Or, yeah, I've seen Hoarders where it's always just stacks of newspapers.
News, yes. Yeah.
And then they find a cat under something.
Oh, yeah.
The cat's fine. The cat eats newspapers. He's doing great.
Well, okay. So first, let's just go back to your thing real quick, your thermometer.
Yeah.
In the context of hoarding, how do you know when to get rid of it? And for you, you just said, like, when it's not working anymore.
When it's
not
working, being functional.
I'm going to let it go. Right.
Correct.
You know, you might be somebody who collects thermometers, right? What's the difference between a hoarder and a collector? Well, it turns out there are some things. If you're living with hoarding disorder, and I should say there is no, as far as I could figure out, there is no official diagnosis of hoarding disorder, but a lot of people think there should be. It is usually tied to other comorbid conditions. We'll talk about that in a second.
Got it. Call it dishoarding?
If you're unhoarding? Because the dishoarding would be like, yeah.
Good point.
And then you could be a rehoarder.
You just own nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just sitting in an empty room.
Right, right. If you're living with hoarding disorder, though, you likely compulsively collect objects or animals or books or papers, photos, clothes, containers, food. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, you might even hoard garbage and human waste.
What?
People who struggle with hoarding behavior likely live alone. They are 3 times more likely to be obese than the average person. They are also perfectionistic, and they have at least one other family member that is a hoarder. That's the bananas part, that no one really knows when hoarding starts. But a lot of clinicians believe that it's connected with your genetic history, that accounting for 50% of hoarding tendencies is directly related to genetics. A history of obsessive compulsive disorder, 1 in 4 people with OCD have some sort of compulsive hoarding behavior and some other trauma that is related to some sort of PTSD. It's also comorbid with substance abuse disorder and depression and anxiety and schizophrenia and dementia. And that's why I think my bold thesis is that you, like when you say that's always tickled me in a kind of uncomfortable way, because when we are living with anxiety, I think we're always like a brushstroke away from some of these behaviors that that feel like, I could go down that direction. I could go there pretty quickly.
There, but for the grace of God, go I, kind
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly. And that's why it's so scary and why it's so serious, right? It's so serious.
Yeah.
So I started watching some of these. This morning was a real dark place. So I'm prepping for this because I'd already looked up all the research. So I thought, you know, I've never really sat down to watch these hoarding shows, right? They've never really been something that I thought would appeal to me. And so I started watching some British ones. Jasmine Harmon on The Only Human Show. I think it's a BBC show. And she did a Biggest Hoarders documentary and has done several since about helping hoarders. Her mother was a hoarder and she spent a lot of time investigating this. And there are some... just some quotes that really stuck with me. I look at all these books as friends. Every one of these things is a friend. When asked, how do all these things get on the floor? And the response is, well, they fall. But there's never any discussion of getting them picked up. It's just more stuff gets put where they were. And these homes are so full of things, trash, food, rusted cans of food that has not been eaten, that might have been opened and put back on the shelf. Like, it is an extraordinary, 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 just destruction of a life through stuff.
Yeah.
But here's the trick. All of them have the same sort of scenario, that the people who are dealing with hoarding have developed a relationship with objects as fast and as deeply as we develop relationships with other people, right? And animals too, right? You have people who hoard animals and thereby end up neglecting animals horribly because there are too many animals.
Because there's too many.
Yeah, there are too many
animals. But I get the idea. I shouldn't say I get it. It's more accessible to me having that behavior towards an animal, towards a living thing that you're getting from. Towards cans or newspapers, I can't make that connection.
Yeah. Well, and there is there's another distinction to that again. I don't know if the connection is in there, but there was one gentleman who had kind of a behavior that I could really relate with. And he had been a hoarder for decades, and his house was a disaster. You know, he couldn't move. He couldn't walk up and down the stairs safely. He was, every step in his house was stepping on garbage, paper, old food. So there was no exposed floor anymore. Just aisles and aisles of things. Walking into to the house with the wife, who is not a hoarder, but has been effectively enabling the hoarding behavior of her husband.
Yeah.
You know, the reporter says, what's in there? It's a room. It's a doorway. And the room is completely full to the brim. It looks like a closet that's just been stuffed full. And the woman says, well, that's the living room. I haven't been in there in about 12 years. Right? I mean, it's just closed with stuff. You just can't get in there anymore. And so, you know, the behavior, though, when talking about how to move through this and try to get control of it, is this gentleman kept saying, you know, I understand, I know that I need some help, but I want to evaluate every single item before it leaves my house.
Right.
I want to make sure that I'm not giving up on a relationship. Right. That's the subtext. I want to make sure that I'm not selling something close to me, something close to my heart that is imbued with feeling, right? That I'm giving it some life. I'm anthropomorphizing it somehow.
Right.
And that's why I'm keeping it around.
Are they related to memories?
Possibly.
Is it like getting rid of something is sort of, in a way, analogous to getting rid of part of yourself?
Possibly. But what's interesting about it then is when you have the right kind of therapy, and they demonstrated some of this cognitive behavior therapy that's going on in here, they're great examples of people who, you know, they find a way to enjoy their space and time. They're able to let go of things with the right coaching. But this thing that stuck with me is they kind of ended on the money quote in this particular documentary. Is a woman who's a hoarder, and she said, you know, I love having my family over at my house now. I love having them, you know, be able to walk through my kitchen. I love being able to cook. And I love that I was able to get rid of all these things. And she takes a beat and comes back and says, oh, I'm still a hoarder.
Oh.
Yeah. Right?
What?
That there is an ever-present fear. It's like once an addict, always an addict, you know?
Yeah.
Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a hoarder, always a hoarder. Like, you get this sense that any second she's going to find a coffee can and develop a very deep relationship with it and never be able to give it away.
Wow.
It's terrifying. Just the act of reading the statistics made me feel a sense of just, like, at the same time, a bereft, like, hopelessness about that, because some of this stems from the emotional psychological disorder of trauma and OCD and all these things that we live with, and some of it is exacerbated by consumer culture and like all of these things. Like, I just can't imagine in, you know, the year 1200 that people were, you know, collecting spears and sticks, you know, as they're riding through the English countryside. I just don't imagine that they would be
just a cave full of dinosaurs.
It's like, you know, like, was Robin Hood a hoarder? I don't know. I have a hard time imagining that. But I do.
Rob from the rich and keep it.
God, you're right.
Rob from the rich and put it in there.
King Richard was actually the first hoarder. And anyway.
I think one of the things that also tickles within me is, it seems like visual anxiety.
Yes.
In that when your anxiety is getting worse and worse and worse, it's all inside, and it can become unmanageable, or you reach a tipping point.
Yeah.
Having that kind of, like, that amount, there's no floor left. You can't even go in that room. It almost seems like there's just too much to tackle.
Yeah.
Like, how do you even start?
Yeah.
And so maybe just let it, it's almost just like denying something. That's really rough.
Yeah. Well, and that is, it goes back to where we started, like, looking, as I'm walking around my house, seeing two of everything, recognizing that I'm tickled in this kind of way, and the pandemic exacerbates that. Like,
yep.
I start to feel like, oh, yeah, I can see how, I can see that there is a path from where I am right here to closing off my living room, right? There is a path. I don't know that I'm walking on it right now. I'm aware of it, but I know what it feels like. I can put myself there and it's uncomfortable. I don't like it. And I think it's really scary, and it's very real, and it's not funny at all. We laugh because if we weren't laughing, we would be crying. Like, that's pretty much it. So how do you feel? Are you feeling okay?
No, I am feeling good. I was thinking how embarrassed I would be if my camera fell off and hit the desk and you just see piles of thermometers. And I'd be like, oh, my friends!
I'm a collector! I'm a collector! I'm a collector.
Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. This week's tune is Lucky Me by Offerin.
I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Tommy Metz III. Thank you for downloading. We'll be back next week on What's That Smell?